You know, one thing I write about in the book is this capacity for interoception, which is the flow of sensations that are always there from within our body, but we're really encouraged, especially in situations where we're supposed to be thinking hard and working hard, to push those internal sensations away, which again is a mistake because they carry so much information and so much wisdom if we tune into them.
All right, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, and by trade and training, I am a sport and performance psychologist, fortunate to work with some of the most extraordinary thinkers and doers across the planet. And the whole idea behind this podcast, behind these conversations, is to learn from people, to pull back the curtain, to explore how the extraordinaries commit to both mastering their craft and their minds. Now, our minds are our greatest asset, but you have to work with your mind. It is not something that is a born right. There are skills to build. And this is just a quick little note here. If you want to learn more about how you can formally train your mind, I want to encourage you to check out the online course that we built, where it's pulling back the curtain and showing you exactly what we consider to be the best practices to meet that intersection of the psychology of high performance and the psychology of well-being. So we walk through 16 essential principles and skills for you to train your mind in the same way that we train world-class athletes. And you can find all of that at findingmastery.net/course. I cannot imagine a better investment to make in yourself for your community by getting your stuff right. And so I want to encourage you to check it out. Again, it's at findingmastery.net/course. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time in early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well, so be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. HIMS.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Okay, this week's conversation is with Annie Murphy Paul. She's an acclaimed science writer. She's a graduate of Yale University and the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, and she's currently a Learning Science Exchange Fellow at New America. So Annie's TED Talk, which was titled, What We Learn Before We're Born, first grabbed my attention, and there's millions of downloads on that. But then when she came out with her book called The Extended Mind, The Power of Thinking Outside the Brain, I was like, what is the extended mind? And when I was going through her work, it's really cool. The idea of how we can extend the power of our mind through our environmental conditions. And with that, let's jump right into this week's conversation with Annie Murphy Paul. Annie, how are you?
I'm good, Michael. How are you?
Yeah, I believe you when you say that. It sounds like and it feels like life is good for you. So congratulations on your book that you've introduced to the
Thank
world.
You.
And I'm excited to dive into it with you. But why do I feel that exuberance and that authenticity when you say I'm good? Where's that come from?
Well, I live in Connecticut, and it's a really beautiful fall day here, crisp weather, the leaves are turning. I think that weather has a big impact on my mood, as it does for many people.
And did you grow up there? Did you grow up on the East Coast of the United States?
I did, outside Philadelphia. So this is kind of my most favorite time of year.
Okay, cool. And then what was it like growing up? Just a quick pass. Give us a sense of, what was the family like? What was the socioeconomic status about? What was the main conversations that you had around the dinner table?
Oh, such an interesting question. Well, I grew up in a middle-class family. I was the kind of bookish nerd of the family, and I always had my nose in a book. My father actually, he was a social worker, but before that he was a member of a religious order, the Christian Brothers. And so at some early point I decided that religion was not for me. And so, but he and I had many spirited debates about theology and religion. Much to his credit, he didn't impose his views on me. It just became actually a way for us to connect. So I've always thought of those conversations as one of the foundations of my career as a writer and a thinker.
I love this. What is Christian Brotherhood? What is that about?
They're a teaching order, kind of like the Jesuits. So they take vows of chastity and poverty and all that stuff, but they're out in the world teaching. And my father was joined when he was 19 and then left when he was 35 because he wanted to have a family. So my sister and I always said that we really needed to be good because dad left God for us.
Oh my, is that a joke? Is that for real? No, that's for real, isn't it?
There was a little feeling of that. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
And then you have a spirit where you like to find ways to push back. Is that like the essence of the challenge relationship with your father?
Mm-hmm. To ask questions. And I am grateful to my dad. He died about 8 years ago, but I'm grateful to him that my questions were not quashed. They were invited and, welcomed. And I do think of myself as having a very, as I said, bookish kind of living in my head kind of childhood and young adulthood. And so the book that I wrote, The Extended Mind, is actually about coming out of your head and living in your body and being aware of the space you're in and your connections with other people. So I kind of think it was the book that I needed to write. It was like the book, the things that I needed to teach myself.
Isn't that always the case?
Yeah, I think it is. We write what we need to learn. Yeah, for sure.
When I first started 20 some years ago in being a psychologist, one of my mentors says to me, Mike, you realize that everything that you're going to need to work on is going to show up in the chair next to you or across from you. And so it was a nod to the idea that in all of your relationships, professional or otherwise, you will see and experience triggers, and those triggers are yours. You know, it's not, they might have brought them into the room, but that's your stuff now. And so don't be confused. You know, you're a mess and you need to keep working. And so, you know, So it sounds like this is one of your processes to take the early childhood bookworm experience, the questioning of big ideas, and to say, you know, I kind of feel stuck in my head. And, you know, what's this other part of this link between the mind and the body? Does that sound close to being right?
That does. And I think, you know, often we're drawn to the things that that don't come naturally to us. And so that can create a challenge. It would be easier to stay with what feels comfortable. But I kept finding myself drawn as a science writer to these bodies of research that were about, no, we don't just think with our brains, we think with our bodies. No, it matters where you are. That affects how you think. And no, we don't just think with our own minds. And I've been a freelance writer for 25 years, which is a very solitary kind of occupation. And here I am writing about the joys of working in groups, you know? So I think it's almost like a magnetic attraction to all the things that make you a little bit uncomfortable. And you can either resist that or you can go with that and find out more.
So let's do something. I want to do a flyover really quickly about what we want to make sure we touch on. And I want to start with a differentiation first. And then I also want to, in between those two, the flyover and the differentiator, I want to understand, like, what does a successful life mean to you? And so there's like this next little segment will be those three parts. So on the first part here, what is the difference between the mind and the brain? And how have you come? That's a loaded question. I think about this a lot. And this is not like to get into a debate about anything, but I want to know how you think about the mind and the brain.
Right. Well, that's a great question because it gets right at the heart of this idea of the extended mind, which my book is built around, because the conventional understanding is that mind and brain are identical, that they're contiguous, that the mind is the brain, that the mind is contained within the brain. And what the extended mind, the theory of the extended mind says is no, the mind is much bigger than that. The mind extends out from the brain through the body, you know, below the neck and out into the world, our surroundings, our environment, and into the relationships that we have with other people. And that's where thinking is happening. That's where the magic is happening, not in here, but out here, you know, and it's really, to me, profound and transformative kind of idea that can really change how you see yourself and others in the world.
So the brain is the tissue. And it's got chemistry and matter and, you know, electricity and a beautifully complicated interwoven network and more of an ecosystem than a network. And that's the brain. And the mind, you're saying, is more like the unified field where it is a collective consciousness, where there's an individual aspect to it as well as an invisible networked aspect to it. Do I hear that correctly?
Yes. And I think another important thing to remember.
There's a slight pause in there. So course correct.
I like that stuff about unified field. I mean, those aren't words that I use, but I think it's important to remember that the brain is a very limited and quirky and idiosyncratic organ. It's obviously a biological organ with all the limitations that come along with that. And it's an evolved organ that evolved to do things that are very different from what we ask of it today, you know, to deal with all these abstract and conceptual kinds of ideas. So in order to meet the moment, you know, to function in our modern world, the brain needs a lot of help. And that's where these outside the brain resources come in.
And you know what I really appreciate is that you've introduced an idea, which is really important, which is the brain has limits and, you know, the mental aspect of our life as well is not boundless with quote unquote energy, you know, like as a resource, like both of them have, there's limitations to it. And so I'm really excited to dive into that with you as well, because I think that's a really important, I don't want to say footnote because it's like the main thesis, but it sits underneath how we think about getting better and how we think about recovery and how we think about engagement you know, with things that are important to engage with. So it's yeah. foundational to me. And then quickly, like, what does success mean to you? Like, just mm-hmm. life success, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I've always found Sigmund Freud's formulation useful. He said, love and work, you know, those are the two things that matter. And to me, meaningful work and really rich, deep, authentic connections with other people. Those, you know, keep it simple. I think those two things are they're the foundations of my life. And I've been lucky enough to have them be the core of my life. And to me, that's what success is.
You know, when you're going down the path with Sigmund, I was like, oh boy, where's this going? Like, you know, something, yeah. you know, like he, you know, he was out there and he did some really interesting stuff. Most has been, you know, from a scientific framework has been, it hasn't held up, you know, mm-hmm. ego, mm-hmm. superego. Mm-hmm. But then the thinking and the philosophical opining mm-hmm. was brilliant mm-hmm. and game changing for the industry. So his place is duly noted. And if he would have known this study, and I've referenced this study all the time, I'm fascinated by it, but Harvard did a 75-year study studying fulfillment. And two of the key factors that you just mentioned mm-hmm. came back as purpose is what they found was part mm-hmm. of fulfillment. Answering the big questions in life was mm-hmm. part of it, and meaningful relationships. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so pretty cool finding. And he was on it. And it sounds like you're on it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, there's a lot of ways to say or to approach the same kind of core truths. And those three sound pretty good too. I like answering the big questions. I would certainly put that at the heart of my life as well.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Okay. And then, so on the flyover here, on this third part of this question, on the flyover, what do you want to make sure that we hit? Because there's so many ways I feel like you and I can mm-hmm. go in this conversation. Mm-hmm. So what would be the mm-hmm. three big buckets, if you will, that mm-hmm. would be important for us to hit?
Mm-hmm. Well, just as an overall thing for your listeners to remember, I would want them to know that they have access right now to so many avenues and resources to think better, and that they may be constrained right now by a misunderstanding of how thinking works, and that there's a way to escape that conventional limitation and to take advantage of all these outside the brain resources that are really our heritage as human beings. They're really, you know, it's our own culture and our own society that has placed these limits on us that tell us that, you know, the brain is what does all the work, and that the body has nothing to contribute to intelligent thinking, or that in our very individualistic culture, that it's all about you, the individual, and not about what you can do with other people, or the idea that where you are doesn't really matter, that you should be able to function just the same outdoors or indoors, or, you know, in a place where you feel comfortable and empowered, or in a cubicle that, you know, is yours today and won't be yours tomorrow, that kind of thing. So mainly I would love for your listeners to understand that there's this whole world of potential out there that is already ours. We just kind of need to claim it.
Okay, cool. Okay. So when we double dip under that, or double click underneath that double mm-hmm. dip, I don't know where that came from, but when mm-hmm. we double click underneath that, we can get into some tactics and some ways, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. some resources. But maybe let's start with, what is the extended mind?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a cool phrase.
It is. And I mm-hmm. should say right up front, it is not my idea. I borrowed it from two philosophers. And these two philosophers, Andy Clark and David Chalmers, wrote an article in 1998 that was, interestingly, at the time was widely sort of mocked and derided. It only later became one of the most cited articles in the philosophy literature and the model for all kinds of research and ideas that have sprung from the extended mind. But when they first proposed it, people were like, wow, that's crazy. And what they were saying was just what we've been talking about here, that thinking doesn't just happen in the brain. It happens in our bodies, in our spaces, in our relationships, also with our tools, like our devices and our technologies, our analog tools, that we think with those objects as well. And what's interesting is that when they published that article in 1998, the iPhone had not yet been introduced. So they couldn't use that as an example. But once it was introduced, all of us started downloading many of our mental functions to our phones, right? I mean, who remembers phone numbers anymore? Because our phones do that for us. And so slowly, with the introduction of this technology, the idea that thinking doesn't only happen in the brain became more and more plausible. So such that another philosopher, a colleague of David Chalmers, said that the thesis of the extended mind was false when it was written, but later became true. You know, and I think actually the way that we extend our minds with our devices is actually probably the easiest way into understanding this idea, because our devices are really designed to extend our minds, you know, although I would point out that often they don't have that effect. They end up sort of contracting our minds because we get distracted, or, you know, that they're actually not extending our minds so much as dissipating our mental energy. But I think we all have had that experience of downloading or offloading mental functions onto our devices.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, hydrow.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you go check them out. Very cool. And just as a footnote, David, Dr. Chalmers is foundational in thinking about the hard problem of consciousness. And, you know, when he first introduced his position paper, it was watershed. it was a watershed position paper. And so mm-hmm. I love that you're pulling from, you know, mm-hmm. foundational philosophical thinking about mm-hmm. consciousness and making it really practical, which is, okay, this thing called the smartphone, it's a tool and it's extended mm-hmm. your mind. In other right. words, like a calculator would be a good mm-hmm. example
absolutely.
In the past, or a sundial might have been, you know, part of the way back in the day, or, you know, it's certainly a smart watch mm-hmm. would be another mm-hmm. example. So when you think about, or when you say that we think with our body and we think mm-hmm. of with our tools, what does mm-hmm. it mean to think with our body?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, there's, you know, the body is so intimately and intricately connected with the brain. And this is, you know, this is a fact that scientists are elaborating and deepening our knowledge of every day. But that goes against a very old and entrenched idea in our culture that mind and body are separate, you know, and mind is elevated above the body, and the mind is sort of cerebral and pure, and the body is grubby and dirty and irrational and unruly and has nothing to contribute to intelligent thought. But we know that that's incorrect, and that there's so many ways in which the body contributes to the thinking process. You know, one might be, right now as I'm talking, I'm moving my hands around, gesture, for example. Gesture is not just kind of a tag along to speech. It's actually the case that our gestures anticipate what we're thinking and what we're going to say by a few milliseconds, such that by the time we've said something, our hand gestures are already conveying that information. And often our most advanced, our newest and most cutting edge ideas, they show up first in our gestures. And then that kind of informs our own thinking. The real leader in this field is a University of Chicago psychologist named Susan Golden Meadow, a beautiful name. Susan Golden Meadow is a leading researcher in gesture. And she has shown that, for example, when children are wrestling with learning a new concept, often an understanding of the concept will show up first in their hands, even as they're saying what they're saying reflects that old outdated assumption. And when teachers can be aware of that mismatch between what a student's hands are saying and what they're saying verbally, that is a signal to a teacher that that student is ready to make the leap to this new understanding. They're especially receptive to instruction at that moment. And so just paying more attention to what people's gestures are saying, and also encouraging people to make gestures, making a lot of gestures ourselves, all these things move our thinking forward in ways that would not happen if our hands were not moving.
It's confusing to me, because I know the value of gestures for communication. And mm-hmm. what I hear mm-hmm. you saying is that we have a thought, and once we have a thought, it actually formalizes in a gesture before it does, we find the right language to express it.
That's right. So it is the case, as you mentioned, that gestures are a very potent tool in communication. Like, people remember what we say, the points that we make when they're accompanied by gesture, more than they remember things that we say when we're not gesturing. So, you know, gesturing is a really powerful way to communicate our ideas to other people. But it's also the case that gesturing is it's part of our own thinking processes and moves our own thinking processes forward, such that the more we gesture, the more fluent our own speech is, the more easily we understand complex concepts. And that's partly because when we're struggling to put words to an idea, often we can capture some element of that and with our hands before we're really able to put words to it, as you were saying, Michael. And so it's kind of a bootstrapping thing where, like, our hands give us just a little bit of a leg up, to use an embodied metaphor. And we kind of can build on that to build a more formalized verbal understanding.
That's very cool. And is it a speed thing, that hand gestures come out before the verbal? There's so many words that we can choose to describe something. Even I just stammered finding the word. And is it a speed thing and a rudimentary thing, that there's less gestures maybe, or smaller range of gestures than a smaller range of words?
Yeah. Or like our hands can move faster than our minds mm-hmm. can create the words. That's a good question. I know that research has found that interacting with objects, like manipulating objects, is actually often a faster way to solve a problem than doing it all in our head. And we have this bias in our culture that real smart people do it all in their head, when really the more you can externalize the thinking process, whether it's gestures or a model that you're actually able to physically manipulate, that kind of thing, that's actually what experts do. You know, that's actually the root of experts' mastery, is that they're really good at thinking outside the brain. They're really good at using their bodies, using spaces, using relationships to help their thinking along.
Yeah, it makes sense that when you're holding something that you're trying to solve, that you would actually be pulling in more data points, accessing mm-hmm. different regions of the brain, if you mm-hmm. will, to be mm-hmm. super simple. Mm-hmm. But that totally makes sense to me. And mm-hmm. We also know that kids, I think it's boys in general, but strike me if I'm wrong on that, or strike this thought if I'm wrong, is that, don't strike me. but boys learn better when they hold something in their hand. And there's a lot of funny jokes that can come from that. But I think that, I don't know if that still holds true, but I remember reading that at one point. Mm. And then I'll tell you a funny story, is that I was working with a bunch of athletes, and it happened to be a media training day. And the specialist, the expert, came in and said, right, okay, let's make sure that you have the right type of eye gaze into the camera. So she was teaching them how to look into the camera. And then make sure you sit on your suit, so the back of your suit, so that your collar doesn't ruffle up. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, I want you to tuck your hands underneath your hips and sit on your hands. Mm. And I always thought that was really weird. And I thought, well, my Italian ass is going to have a hard time. You know, like, I'm not sure what I'm going to do here. And so
it felt really... And stay like that?
Yeah. The whole interview.
Wow. So,
right. And so it was like... like, just make it about the eye contact, the words you choose, and have that presence. And don't be flailing and distracting, you know, with hand gestures, was like probably the note that she had received from producers or something. So anyways, I don't know how that went for those athletes, but I always thought it stuck with me that is really odd and confining.
That's misguided. Yeah, I tell a story in the book about Frederick Mishkin, who's a professor at Columbia Business School, and he's a big hand talker and always has been. And when he was in graduate school, his graduate school advisor made him sit, whenever he visited his advisor to consult with him about his studies, the advisor forced him to sit on his hands because he found Frederick Mishkin's gestures so distracting, or gauche, or whatever. And we do have this kind of stigma that we apply to anything that has to do with the body, including gestures, which is it's so wrongheaded. And I think that's true in your example as well, Michael, that gestures are actually part of the thinking process, an integral part of the thinking process. They help us to think better. And so to suppress that is really a mistake.
We'll leave this point, but I'll share one more misguided bit of advice. And this is why advice, quote unquote, is crazy making to me. You know, it's like half-cocked, what kind of worked for me, or I heard it from somebody. Like, let's get into the science of things and not just this advice giving bit. But it was for a salesperson. I think that this is half true. You know what I'm about to say. So it was athletes, there's this idea that athletes make good salespeople and good business people because they are self-starters. They know how to work and schedule. They're good teammates. They understand grit and passion and, you know, fill in the blanks with lots of ideas. And some athletes are really long. And so here's where the coaching came in. And again, half-cocked, I think it's totally wrong, but this athlete was 6'8". That's a very large human. And the coaching was to keep your limbs in. When you're going to a sales meeting, like, become smaller a bit, like tuck your knees under the table in a way that they're not sprawling, and, you know, your 7-foot wingspan is not intimidating people. And so it was more of an intimidation and like this creature of an expansion with these long arms that was overwhelming for people. And they were spending more time thinking about how small they were relative to how strong and big this person was. And so the coaching was keep your limbs in. And so I don't know if that really has to do with gestures or not, but just interesting experience. Like, people are different, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we show it differently.
I would say, you know, how much better if that athlete could have been encouraged to own his size and feel empowered, but bring other people into that feeling of empowerment rather than, you know, diminishing himself to make other people feel less small.
Yeah, that was the tactic. You're so large that you make others feel small. So play small, which is like, can you imagine telling that to like a child?
LeBron James or something.
Yeah. Or even like, I don't know if you have kids, but like, would you ever say that to your kid? I mean.
Well, unfortunately, I think girls get told that a lot, you know, that they're
in what way?
That their role is to make other people feel big and strong and to diminish themselves, to keep their voices low. And, you know, even to physically, you know, there's all the jokes about man spreading, how men sit on like a subway car, you know, and women are
man
kind
spreading.
Of you know, much more.
I've heard mansplaining,
no,
but not manspreading.
Yeah, manspreading too. Where men
is this like when the hips roll forward and the legs are like spread out? Is that what
they're taking up way more space than they really need to. So I think there is something about gender that comes into play there too.
Yeah. You know, and while we're on bodies and the thinking and the relationship people have with their bodies, tall people end up not getting hugged in the same, yet not as often, you know, and not, because imagine like, and I'm talking extremely tall people, like 6'7", 8'9", 7' footers. It's because when you hug a 6'8" person or 7' person,
you're right at their
hip, or you know, it's like, and so they have to come down, and it's a whole thing.
Right.
So it's more handshake, fist bumps. Yeah. So imagine growing up and the warmth that we get from hugs. That the 6'4" kid in ninth grade or 6' three kid in ninth grade it's just a different relationship with hugging. Anyways, I'm not sure where we're going, but it's interesting.
All this embodied stuff is so interesting because our bodies are with us all the time. And, you know, one thing I write about in the book is this capacity for interoception, which is the flow of sensations that are always there from within our body, but we're really encouraged, especially in situations where we're supposed to be thinking hard and working hard, to push those internal sensations away, which again is a mistake because they carry so much information and so much wisdom if we tune into them.
So can you define interoception for folks that are not familiar with it? Because it is it's beautiful. It's not talked about enough. It's part of an intelligence that happens for people. So can you quickly just pass over that?
Yeah. I mean, interoception is a term that it's a technical term that I had not encountered until I started doing this research. And I think it's the same capacity is much better known under the term gut feelings, you know? And so what it describes is kind of that sensation or feeling you have that is informative, that tells you something, but it doesn't seem to come from your brain or from your conscious mind. And that is in fact the case, that, you know, we take in so much information as we're navigating through our everyday lives that we couldn't possibly process it all on a conscious level. But we are taking in that information. We are noticing patterns and regularities in our experience. And the way we get access to that information is through the body. Like, that's what's happening when your stomach, you know, you have butterflies in your stomach, or you feel your heart beating faster. That's your body cluing you in to the fact that here's a situation that you've got to pay attention to. And it's kind of like the body tapping you on the shoulder or tugging you on the sleeve to give you a message. But our culture is so brain-centric that we tend to push away those messages and assume that they don't have any relevance.
That's really good. It's a really important part of quote unquote thriving in life, is to have the ability to be attuned to what the body is saying, and then having the resources to be able to respond.
Yes.
And so can we paint a picture really quickly of somebody who, this is like a modern day human right now that is working their ass off. They're trying to do their thing, giving their full effort. They're pulled in more directions that they might have wanted, meaning that they're stretched, right? Mm-hmm. Literally at their limits. Mm-hmm. But they want to learn, they want to grow, they want to show up, and they want to be right for their family and or, you know, definitely for their career. And they end up feeling depleted at the end of the day or the end of the week, or they're just, you know, there's this deep fatigue that's taking place for people. And so can you talk about if you were to be able to help those people, that person, where would you start?
Well, in the book, I write about this technique called the body scan, which those of your listeners who practice mindfulness meditation may have encountered. And it's about bringing open-minded, curious, non-judgmental attention to what's happening, to whatever is coming up, whatever is being felt in the body. And usually it is a kind of formal practice that you would do before you proceed to do mindfulness meditation. But what I've found and what researchers have found is that it can also be done on a much more kind of on the go way and in a much briefer kind of way, in the sense of just checking in with yourself, you know. And we're so focused on the external world. We're so focused on all this information that's coming at us that we often forget to check in with what's going on inside. Like, in addition to this very, very vivid and busy external world, there's an internal world as well. And we often are neglecting, you know, that internal world. And so what you want to do ideally is to be drawing from both of those spaces, you know, drawing on what's happening in the external world, but also checking in with what's going on in the internal world. And it only needs to take a moment or two to check in and with yourself and say, how am I feeling? What am I feeling? You know, it's a very helpful to label what you're feeling, to just put a name to what you're feeling. And I find that that's something that even very busy people can incorporate into their everyday lives.
Yeah. So it's thin slicing of checking in. And there's good evidence that it works. And what I found is that the person who's highly stressed, that isn't practicing in a disciplined way, a checking in or a formal meditation process, that they're less likely to check in when you know their foot is 3/4 the way down on the pedal. I think it's really important. And there are ways that we can maybe add to what you just said, which is schedule it. You know, if it doesn't make people's calendars nowadays, it's actually quite tricky. Use your external environment. Maybe this is part of the freeing up, you know, the bandwidth idea that you have of offloading, but using some post-it notes to check in at different cues throughout their office or home. And you're right that it's a simple breath and a simple labeling. Both have evidence that they dissipate the stress that is experienced or the emotion that is being labeled. So, okay, so great. And now let's get into maybe the four ways that you think about offloading. And we've talked about the body. That's I think that's what we just did, right? And there's also technology, physical space, and social interaction. Yeah. So can you kind of click through ways that you would help offload from a technology standpoint for the busy, caring human that's trying to do really well in life?
Yeah. Yeah. So we've talked about how our devices can be very good at offloading our mental functions onto them. But we want to do that really intentionally and skillfully, because our own mental capacities can atrophy, you know, if we hand off too much of that to our devices. Just think about, you know, maybe you've traveled a particular route a whole bunch of times, but you use GPS every time. And if without that GPS, you'd never be able to find your way there, you know. What we really want to do in terms of offloading our mental functions onto our devices is, as much as possible, offload those mundane, routine, kind of everyday kind of mental tasks onto our devices. And in fact, they often do a better job of handling those things than we do. For example, if we put something in Google Calendar, our computer won't misremember it as being Thursday instead of Wednesday. You know, computers are better than us. It's better than our own brains at doing certain things like keeping information, preserving information in that original state. Whereas our own minds are amazing at sort of elaborating and, you know, transforming things and changing them into new ideas, combining ideas to create something new. And so as much as possible, we want to delegate, you know, the routine stuff to our machines, to our technology, freeing up bandwidth for the stuff that only humans can do, you know, having the big ideas, the creative ideas, making the connections. So that's the most effective way to use our devices.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they've found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTrue.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's aquatrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. Calendaring is an easy one. Maybe we can double click on some other ones that you found to be useful for you and maybe useful for others.
Yeah, well, memory in general, you know, this goes back to our earlier conversation about how the biological brain is quite limited. We're not really good at remembering exact information, that the brain extracts the gist from a situation and we kind of remember basically what something was about, but a computer is very good at remembering exactly what the details are and those details don't change. So A lot of those functions that we'd want to download to our devices really do have to do with memory and a very precise and exact kind of memory.
Okay, very cool. And, you know, I think we're hitting on a couple of them, right, with the physical space. Like, is that Post-its like I was talking about? Or are there other ones that you would say using your physical space as a way of offloading is important?
Yeah, well, there is the space of ideas, which is what I mean when I talk about getting stuff out of your head, ideas and information out of your head and onto physical space, whether that's like a giant whiteboard or a bunch of Post-it notes that you can actually manipulate as if they're physical objects or navigate through as if it's like a three-dimensional landscape. Those are all things that our brains do really effortlessly and easily. And it draws on these embodied resources that come so naturally to us that we use so effectively, but that don't even get activated if we keep all that information and all those ideas inside our head. But I also mean literally physical space, as in spending lots of time outdoors, because it turns out that being indoors and focusing on very intently on the kind of concepts and symbols that make up most of our work is very draining, you know, to our attentional systems. Whereas going outside and having that kind of pleasantly diverting experience of just looking here and there and like not having that really intense draw down on your attention, that restores your attentional faculties. So then you can go back to your office with greater focus and greater attentional ability.
And the research is phenomenal about like outside is ideal, wide open spaces, you know, wide, big ideas, if you will, but wide open spaces is really important. And then not necessary. Like there would be that for me is, this is why I grew up surfing and I loved two aspects of surfing. It was like super vast. And then also you could find details and narrowing of details in the rippling of the top of the water, the shimmering of the light. Like you can go back and forth between the two, which was really, I think, an interesting aspect. Yeah. And plus the magnesium and the kind of the salt air, you know, really? The ions there. Yeah,
there's it sounds so cool.
It's really an amazing thing. And then there's risk and learning, and it's complicated because it's always new. It's like for a lot of reasons, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so big spaces. And then the research is really interesting is that if you can't get big spaces, like, okay, be outside in some respects. And then if you can't do that, be at a near a window, they can see nature. Yeah. And then the least effective, but still effective is a picture of nature that's hanging on your wall.
Or bringing in plants and greenery into our, or even natural motifs into our built settings can be helpful.
How do you explain that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, human beings evolved in the outdoors. This life we live where we're indoors, inside buildings or inside our cars 90% of the time, that is a very recent development if you look at the whole span of human history. So our perceptual faculties are tuned to what we see in the organic world and in the natural world. And a lot of the sharp, you know, edges and loud sounds and fast moving objects that we confront, like in an urban setting, those are stressful. You know, they put a real stress on our nervous system, and being outside is really, it's kind of the sweet spot for our brain. It's very easy to process for our brains to process that information, and what our brains find easy to process, we generally find pleasant. So that's why when we go outside, most of us feel a kind of lifting of our mood every time we just step out the door, you know?
Yeah. So this ancient brain of ours, you know, hasn't quite caught up to some of the modern stressors. And so your tactics are about taking advantage of the true ancient nature and the modern research and inventions that can work in harmony, which is the extended mind, if I have it correctly. And then the fourth is social interaction. So what do you mean by social interaction?
Yeah, well, so I find it interesting that, again, you know, this book is as much a book, a work of cultural criticism as anything else. And I find it really interesting that in our culture, in our society, we tend to separate social life from the life of the mind, you know, the our workplace or our professional lives. Like they're different and they're even at odds. Like we might think of having a drink after work, but then when we're actually at work, you know, we need to focus and turn off that social part of our brain.
Oh, so we're drinking at work now? Is there good research? The team would love it.
I won't argue against that. Yeah. No, but yeah. I mean, humans are fundamentally social creatures. We're social all the time, you know, not just during happy hour. And so the more we can harness our really powerful social brains in the service of thinking and learning and doing our work, the more effective we can be. So social activities like telling stories or debating other people or teaching other people, those activate cognitive processes that remain dormant when we're just thinking alone by ourselves. So I think we should bring a lot, whether it's drinking or not, I think we should bring a lot more of our social selves into our work.
Okay. So best practice for social interaction, scheduling, I'm trying to be clever and like, you know, offloading onto whatever calendar that you're using. And being in person outside and with others. Are we talking about like the trifecta or the quad of offloading extendamon?
Mm-hmm. Well, and we haven't even talked about the value of physical activity for thinking, but when you can be active, physically active outside with a friend, that's like the ideal. I think you're hitting like every sweet spot there.
And then do you have a recommendation for if somebody is working, you know, 12-hour day, 8-hour day, whatever it might be, and they're inside for most of it, a best practice that you found to be important for you on the relationship between inside and outside?
Yeah. Well, as we were saying, you know, even looking out the window, research finds that even looking out the window for at a scene of greenery for 40 seconds, as little as 40 seconds, can refresh that attentional capacity. And also, I suggest to people that instead of, you know, when you have a break in work, not turning to Twitter and not turning to the news, which is really going to, if anything, will bring you down, but watching a nature video instead. And it's actually, I do it myself, and it's actually incredibly, it kind of puts you back in touch with the fact that we live in this big world. We are animals ourselves, you know, and it's very easy to get caught up in the day's debate, but to step back and have the bigger view, I think can be really useful.
And are you doing that every hour, every 45 minutes, every 3 hours, once a day, you know, like how do you do it? And I know that you would probably talk about sunlight in a minute, vitamin D, magnesium, sunlight for just a moment. But can you talk about like the cadence?
Yeah. I mean, the brain bound, which is a word the philosopher Andy Clark uses that I really like, the brain bound notion of how you get work done is that you sit there until you finish, you know, you keep working your brain. And a lot of us have operated that way during the pandemic because we've been at home. We haven't been commuting. We don't have coworkers around to chat with. And so we just sit there and we work. And I think the limitations of that approach have become apparent over the last 18 months, you know, so it can seem counterintuitive, but to take breaks and breaks of a particular kind can make you more productive. And breaks of a particular kind where you're tuning into your body, having an experience with nature, an encounter with nature, or connecting with another person, like making sure those things happen. That's how I try to structure my workday so that I'm not just using my brain for hours on end, but I'm breaking it up with these specific kinds of experiences.
Okay. If leaders, thoughtful leaders, of course, knew what you knew, how would they set the external conditions and best practices for people to be their very best?
Yeah, I love that question because I really think the extended mind proposes a new role for leaders and managers, that they're really situation creators. They're creators of settings and environments where people can do their best thinking. And though a situation like that, one that is most amenable to intelligent thinking, I think would make lots of space for physical activity, would allow people to take those moments to check in with their introspective selves, would have lots of light and fresh air and access to the outdoors. and would also make space for social activity. You know, people engage, again, we're so fundamentally and naturally social. People engage in activities like storytelling and teaching other people just when they're given space to do so. They don't even really need to be instructed to do that. They just need space and time and the understanding that those things will actually make everybody more productive and more effective. It's not at all a waste of time, quite the opposite.
I love it. What are you still searching for? You've written a book that is hopefully going to change folks. You said you wrote it because you needed it. So now that you've put it down and you know you're sharing it with us.
Yeah.
What are you still searching for?
Yeah.
What's next?
Yeah. One thing I became very aware of while writing this book was how much the richness of the raw materials that we have to think with, how much that informs how well we're able to think. And that's not something we take into account in our current system where we judge people and we rank people based on supposedly what they're doing, you know, up here with their heads, when really so much of their performance has to do with their access to rich materials with which to think. So to me, this is the new kind of frontier of equality and inequality to say, well, really, what materials do people have to think with? And isn't it the case that there's huge disparities in our culture and in the raw materials with which people have to think with? So I've been very fortunate to have the freedom to think well, the mentors and peers to think well with, you know, all those things have, you know, space and time to think with, and all those things have informed my own thinking so much. And so I want to explore that question of equality and inequality in terms of our mental extensions.
Very cool. Yeah, the great digital divide is certainly one that is easy to think about. Outdoors, if you're kind of city bound or indoor bound,
right.
You know, I guess parks are good. They don't feel the same to me as being in the mountains or the ocean, you know, a landscape that is expansive, but maybe, you know, there's interesting research. I'm hesitant to even bring up research around grounding or earthing, you know, because it's, at least I haven't seen the robustness of it, but I, as an N of one, as a person, I feel it. I notice that I'm different when my feet are in the sand or my feet are in the grass. You know, I feel differently. And so but the research, I haven't seen it where it's like a dramatic, like, hey, make sure this happens on a daily basis. But maybe somebody in the community will point me to better research than I've looked at there. Okay. So all that being said is if we could be really concrete, what's one thing that you want to pass to the next generation? If your work is to live on and they were to hold it up and to say, and there was just one thing, for the next generation, what do you hope? And maybe it's not in the book. It doesn't have to be in the book.
I think the theme of all of my work has been, you are not who your society or your culture tells you you are, that there are lots of pressures and forces and incentives to tell you who you are so that you'll be a better consumer or a better worker, you know, or fit into society's idea of what a human should be. But it's your job in the biggest, broadest sense to figure out who you really are. And, you know, to go back, Michael, to your question of what am I still searching for? I'm still searching at bottom for what is true self, you know, what is truly your authentic self and what is all the stuff that gets put on you. And I'm always kind of looking to discover what that is.
This is where mindfulness is really important as a practice. This is where journaling is important. And the third component is conversations with people of wisdom, you know, that are not looking at the surface, but looking at the depths of the human experience and potentially you individually, the depths of you. And true self is a, you know, it's not a word that it gets thrown around a lot and it's not a word that is easily defined. And I think that best self, authentic self, true self, they sound like they're the same, but they're actually quite different. And so, this is a recent conversation that I had on the podcast where we're talking about true self being what's actually more interesting about that phrase is S with a capital S, like the true self of what it means to be fully human. Mm-hmm. And that's the unifying field bit, like this, the common thread that we all have. What are those common threads? And then best self is like wherever you are today, there's a first principle that we're all working to be our very best with the best that we have available each moment that we are, you know, engaged in, but we don't have necessarily the internal resources to be our very best. Mm-hmm. And it's because we, to your point in your research here, that our brains and our minds are limited.
Yeah.
And we need to offload and recover properly and strain in a healthy way and not overextend, you know, on the extended mind, but to do it in a healthy way. So I think those are really important ways for people to wrestle. What is authentic self? What is true self? And what is best self? You know?
And I think the question too is so interesting. What is universal? What is shared? What is human nature? And then what is unique and, you know, really characteristic of yourself and no one else? That's a really interesting vein to work, you know?
Yeah, that's really good. And it sounds like, you know, you are highly attuned to consciousness and the value of it and, you know, the mind, if you will, in general. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with Hoffman's work. We've had Hoffman on the podcast. Have you been exposed? Okay. He's phenomenal. And then Dr. Tony Nader. Tony Nader might be somebody that I think you might be interested in as well. He's a deep, rich thinker. And yeah, so there might be some fun places to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for pointing me in that direction.
Both wrestling with the hard problems of consciousness. Okay. Now, just for fun, if you were to sit with a master, a true master, and you had one question, this is like a definitely a reductionist, you know, idea, but like, or format, but if you were to sit with one master and you had one question, who would it be? And what would it be?
I think, okay, since I mentioned him before, I'm going to say Sigmund Freud again. I'd love
you
to bring
him. You go back to Freud.
I find the psychodynamic approach to understanding human beings, as you were saying, it's more of an art than a science, but I think it has so much to contribute to our understanding of ourselves. And I would want to sit with Sigmund Freud and say, when you look into the human soul, what do you see? You know, I just think he had unparalleled capacities for observing and seeing deeply within people. And I'd want to know, you know, when you listened, when you invented this amazing method of just allowing people to talk and so much comes out and there's so much rich material there, like, what are you looking for? What are you listening for?
Oh, that is cool. That is really cool. I love this conversation. I'm stoked to introduce your work to our community. And here's one more reductionist idea, but you can take it wherever you want.
Okay.
How do you finish this thought? It all comes down to
knowing yourself.
And your best practices for that are?
Well, for sure, introceptive attunement, but a lot of introspection. I mean, I'm still pretty brain bound as a person. I have an analytical mind and I use it. So I think, you know, the value of self-examination is there's not enough of it in this world. And I think there should, you know, I think it can show you things about yourself that you really need to know and it takes some courage and some bravery to do that too, I think.
Incredible courage. I love where you go with this. And do you do that with somebody or do you do it for meditation and or journaling or some other form?
All of the above. I mean, I'm a huge fan of therapy and I have a wonderful therapist and I love reading books about therapy. But also, you know, it's kind of a life project, you know, it's one continuous conversation with myself and with the books I read and with my friends and with my therapist. So it's all just trying to figure out like, what's it all about?
And are you doing psychodynamic work yourself or is it something else?
Yes. Yeah. Kind of a, you know, these days, a lot of therapists have an eclectic kind of approach rather than a very dogmatic kind of one. And I would describe that as the kind of work that I'm doing.
And so your form of therapy, you're not, transference and countertransference are part of the equation, meaning that
that's a real thing.
Yeah, your therapist is not sitting behind you and like,
no,
just
I'm not lying on a couch.
Although
I was once told by another therapist that I was a good candidate for psychoanalysis, and for years I wondered, is that a compliment or is that
what does that mean?
So messed up that you need to be in here 5 days a week, or is it like, oh, you're so thoughtful and you know, introspective, I would go that way.
Yeah, very cool. What super fun. Is there anything that we didn't hit on that you'd say, you know, I wish we would talk a little bit more about this aspect, or I want to encourage people this way, or you know, is there something that is meaningful that we didn't get to?
Yeah, I could just say something that might seem like it's from out of left field, which is there's such a Buddhist flavor to the extended mind, which I'm very interested in Buddhism, but it's not mentioned anywhere in the book, but I think some readers have felt that and have seen the connections. And I feel like there's been a real undercurrent of Buddhism to this conversation, like our discussion about true self and of course meditation and mindfulness. And so I would just encourage, if anybody has ever had, any of your listeners have ever had a stirring of interest in Buddhism, to look into that. I think there's such amazing wisdom there that we in the West could really benefit from. And it's certainly changed my own life.
Oh, so you are practicing Buddhism yourself?
I'm so averse to being part of any kind of a group that I would never say I'm a Buddhist, but I'm right. Very interested in Buddhist thought, and I read a lot about it and practice meditation. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a particular form of meditation that you're experiencing now or has been meaningful to you?
You know, again, the concept of awareness and of identifying with awareness rather than with all these things that, again, society tells you are, allows me to get down to some kind of core, you know, some kind of universal Buddha nature. And I think that that's part of this question we've been debating about: what is universal, what is human nature, and what is our own, you know, particular and contingent take on it. But awareness is the key, I think. You know, there's a story about the Buddha that he encountered someone walking on the road, and this person was struck by the amazing sort of aura around the Buddha and said, "Who are you?" And the Buddha said, "I'm awake." And that was his answer. And I just think that's so beautiful, to like be awake and to have that be the core of your identity. I think that's something to strive for.
It's really cool. And, you know, it is the practice of working to know all there is to know and to experience it in complete awareness. And the idea that you can be tapped into this unifying field, to the collective conscious, to like the thing of the mind that is universal, is remarkable. And we felt it. People have, you know, we just not as an extended experience. And it is quite remarkable. And I think all 11 world religions have done something pretty special, and many of them something pretty egregious, but pretty special in trying to understand what happens, the best way of living according to insight and some practices, and then a best way of understanding what happens after physical death. What I find fascinating is that they keep coming down to the at least one of the two words that you mentioned at the top about, you know, work and love. Love is a through line in all of them. And so it feels like whether it's Buddhism or Christianity, and you know, Jesus was an beautiful example of personified love, you know, and strength. And I can go down the list. I'm fascinated with all 11 world religions. I think that they're... I don't know. It just feels like it's a source code that is not quite unified. And I think you and I would agree that on this point that I've got problems with the dogma and the rules. And if Christianity, this is going to sound, I'm going to piss people off when I say this. I say this to my mom all the time. And, you know, like, it's, I know it's a sore spot, but If Christianity were an institution in the United States, we'd shut that thing down. Right? You abuse kids, you do that. And I mean, if this was a university, that university would be shut down. I don't know if you can come back from those egregious behaviors. And I know I just pissed off a bunch of folks in here. But that's not to say that I don't find the principles of the man and the Trinity to be amazing. And so anyways.
This has been really fun talking with you, Michael.
Yeah, I've appreciated it. And so where can people find you? Where can they, where's the best place to connect people to your work?
Yes. So I have a website that's www.anniemurphypaul.com. I'm also really active on Twitter and I love engaging with people there. And my handle there is @AnnieMurphyPaul.
Okay, awesome. And then I want to encourage people to go check out the book. We will have notes in the show notes and links for everybody. And look forward to seeing you on social as well.
Great. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.